Now, what we're doing right now is we're going through the 12 steps of AA. And for those of you who may be here for the first time, or those of you who are not alcoholics or addicts, you may be thinking, well, how is this relevant for me? Well, I'll tell you. Everybody's recovering from something. And this is the thing that I learned, not being an addict or an alcoholic per se myself, 10, 12 years ago when I started working in recovery, I realized, my gosh, I am just as addicted as anybody here. It's just I used processes as opposed to substances. But the dynamic is exactly the same. And here's the good news. The way through is exactly the same. So it's great because you can be an addict, an alcoholic, or a quote-unquote normie, which is a laughable term. But you can be any of those things in this room. But the way that we're going to talk about to work through these steps, to work through this process, is the same for all of us. And it has to be, doesn't it? Because how many gods are there? One God, one way, right? This one way that leads us back to Father is the same way that you will get through whatever it is that you're addicted to in your life. Whatever the obsessive compulsive patterns that you have formulated over your decades on the planet, the way through those to the other side, to full freedom, freedom from the fear that necessitates those patterns of behavior is the same. And so as we look at the steps were formulated out of the New Testament, and then they were later homogenized to open the tent up beyond Christians, but the principles are still there. Jesus is still there, coded right into the steps. His way that he taught in the New Testament is here, and so that's why we do this, because there's something here for everyone. Now, we are up to the eighth step, and took a break last week, and Pastor Frank spoke. How many here were here to hear Pastor Frank? One of the things that I thought he did a really good job with was to just characterize the steps in the broadest terms. And what he said was that the first three steps are the repair, the restoration of our relationship with God, or the establishment of our relationship with God for the first time. Steps 4 through 7 are the repair, restoration, or establishment of our relationship with ourself. And steps 8 and 9 are the repair, restoration, or establishment of our relationships with others. And then the last three steps are those which help us to maintain and move forward and deepen as we go forward. Because you don't just do the steps once. Oh yeah, I went through the steps, I'm done. No, it's endless cycles. Kind of looks like a spiral, I suppose, because we go around and we come back to one where we started, but we have more insight, and so we're a little bit higher, and so we keep this kind of corkscrew thing going. But there is a cyclical nature to it. So I liked what Frank said. Relationship with God, with self, and with others. But I thought it bears a little bit of explanation as we're going to move into step 8 here. Because what is it that we're really doing when we are establishing a relationship with God? Well, I love God, okay, but what does that really mean? The Proverbs tell us that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And so we wonder what that means. Are we supposed to be afraid of God? What does it mean to fear God? Growing up as a Catholic out of the Baltimore Catechism, you know, we all had to sit there and recite as little first graders. Why are we here? We're here to glorify God. What does glorify God mean? See, to me, and if you take a look at this biblically, it's all the same thing. To establish a relationship with God, to fear God, to glorify God, and even to praise God, is really the same thing. And what it is, it's an acknowledgement of the nature of the relationship that we have with God. What is the nature of our relationship with God? We're dependents. We're vulnerable. We're imperfect. We can't even tie our own shoes. Jesus said, if you can't change one hair white or black on your head, add an inch to your height or an hour to your stature, how is it you think you got any control here? How is it you think you have any power? To admit our powerlessness, to admit the chaotic conditions of our life, is not to say that we don't have a choice, that we're victims. It's simply we recognize and we realize that the only hope we have is to hitch our wagon to the only power in town. We hitch our wagon to the movement of the Spirit as it blows through our life. Now we've got throughput. Now we've got direction. Now we've got impetus. But to acknowledge the nature of that relationship. How do you glorify God? I was always thinking as a kid, we had to run around always saying how great God is. I think he knows. I don't think he needs to be reminded. But to reflect the nature of the relationship that we have with God. To be those children that we were just talking about at the end of worship. to go through life with that kind of joy in the dependence, in the unknowing, not having to control or figure it out, or have all these obsessive compulsive ways of trying to change our circumstances to fit our needs or our mood of the moment, but to be able to go through the flow is to restore, repair, or establish our relationship with God as it really is, accept our dependence, but at the same time, accept our acceptance, even as we're imperfect, that we are loved with a love that can't be lost, because that's who God is. God is love, right? So then what does it mean to restore, repair, or establish our relationship with ourself? Well, that one's a little trickier. You know, we always hear about self-love. You got to love yourself before you can love anyone else. You got to forgive yourself before you can forgive anyone else. Self-esteem is a big thing. So I always think of us, you know, having to go in the morning and look in the mirror and say, you really have a lot going for you. You really are worthy. You know, all these kinds of things. And so there's that movement to try to establish self-esteem, you know, in schools and with kids and so on and so forth, and also with ourselves. But it seems to me it's sort of backwards. It's sort of the cart before the horse, the egg before the chicken, or the chicken before the egg, however that works. Because what self-esteem really is not something that you approach directly and try to manufacture out of whole cloth. Self-esteem really is the byproduct of living your life with purpose, living your life with meaning. And the effect of that is self-esteem. It's not something we just try to grunt out in front of the mirror and just conjure up. It will come as this natural movement through life occurs, as we start to live with purpose. How are we supposed to love ourselves? You ever thought of that? How do you love yourself? C.S. Lewis had a great way of putting it. He said, you know, we're supposed to love our neighbor as ourselves, so how do I love myself? He says, well, you know, come to think of it, I don't really have any affection for myself. You know, I don't really have any sentimentality toward myself. But I feed myself, and I clothe myself, and I educate myself, and I shelter myself, and I do all these things. That caretaking is the way that we love ourselves. And it's the way that we can love our neighbor in that same way. It's not about the feeling of affection. It's about what we do to actually take care of the daily activities of life. And Merton said, if you really analyze love, love is not a feeling. Love really isn't even a behavior. Love is identification with the beloved, actually becoming one with the beloved. And I think that's perfect. I think that's really it. Because the behavior flows from the identification. As soon as we see someone as an extension of ourselves, where the line blurs between us and them, then everything that we do to ourselves is as if we do it to them, and vice versa. We truly are loving our neighbor as ourselves when we are one. Because we all get the same thing at the same time, in that moment, in that presence. And so if we're going to take that concept, that idea that love is really identification, how does that apply to ourselves? Well, see, what happens in us is there becomes a split. Early in childhood, when we first become self-aware, we develop what psychologists have called the ego. There is the ego mind. There is the false self, the false sense of self. It's a natural byproduct of being self-aware, that voice that talks to us in our heads, that attachment that we have to the roles that we play, to the accomplishments and the actions that we perform and the attributes that we have. We have to have those in order to be able to go through life as a human being. The problem comes is when we identify with those things as if they are ourselves. They are not ourselves. They are a byproduct of this brain that we have been given. This brain that can choose between good and evil. This mind that can make abstract thought happen. The problem is, there's a deeper self. There's a self that watches this, that observes all this, that can be connected directly to God's presence. And so to establish a relationship with ourselves is to distinguish between this false self and a true self and identify with that. And see, that's what steps 4 through 7 are all about. If you really think about it, making a list of all of your character defects, making a list of your moral failings, if you will, telling those to another person, becoming entirely ready to have God remove the shortcomings, asking Him for that, That whole process there is consistently separating ourselves from our behavior, separating ourselves from those defects, because that's not who we really are. Now, I was thinking about it, just some things just pop into my mind. Does that ever happen to you? Like, you're just on it, and it's just like, boom. All of a sudden, I saw Spencer Tracy as Father Flanagan in Boys Town. Have you ever seen that movie? Okay, you know what I'm talking about. You Catholics over there. You know what I'm talking about. Anybody seen that movie? Father Flanagan, Spencer Tracy won an Academy Award for a great movie. Mickey Rooney was the JD in it, and he did a great job. Father Flanagan was real. Father Flanagan in 1917 in Omaha got tired of working with homeless men because he had this burning in his heart for young boys. And he started, he borrowed $90 and rented this run-down Victorian house in downtown Omaha and opened a shelter for boys. You know, because back then you didn't have foster families, you didn't have child protective services, you had orphanages, and kids were falling through the cracks left and right. You know, this 1917, remember. But he developed a thinking, a way of conceptualizing his work with children that was really controversial in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. And let me just, I got some quotes from him that just, I love these. He says, "There are no bad boys." Remember that from the movie? There are no bad boys. There's only bad environment, bad training, bad example, and bad thinking. No bad boys. There is nothing the matter with our growing boys that love, proper training, and guidance will not remedy. It costs so little to teach a child to love and so much to teach him to hate. Isn't that great? I've yet to find a single boy who wants to be bad. I do not believe that a child can be reformed by lock and key and bars, or that fear can ever develop a child's character. Think about what was going on in the reform system in the early part of the 20th century. It was just prison for kids. And the guards were brutal. And he's trying to work against that. I do not believe that a child... I said that one. Rehabilitation needs greater emphasis and punishment less. A boy or girl given the proper guidance and direction, kept busy and constructively occupied during their leisure or free time, will prove my statement that there is no such thing as a bad boy or bad girl. And then a couple others that are a little off the point, but I just have to share them because they're so cool. I know that when the idea of a boy's home grew in my mind, I never thought of anything remarkable about taking in all of the races and all of the creeds. To me, they are all God's children. They're my brothers. They are children of God. I must protect them to the best of my ability. Yes. And this other one. Without God at the beginning, there can only be confusion at the end. I love that. Okay, so Father Flanagan's my new best friend. It's just cool. But very controversial, because parenting in the home was strict. Parenting in the home was all about corporal punishment. You are a bad boy. You are a bad girl. Right? And he's trying to make a distinction here. You know, there are no bad boys. There are no bad girls. And today, just so you know, Boys Town also accepts girls now. So they're just working with everyone and families as well. But there's a separation between who we are and the behavior that we end up falling into because of the environment, because of the hurts and traumas, because of all the things that have happened, the examples in our lives. We sometimes fall into this behavior, but that's not who we are. Establishing a relationship with ourselves can discern those things, and that's what we need to find out. We are not the sum of our behaviors. We are not this environment and this bad training and everything that has happened to us over these decades in our life. There's something deeper. We need to have a relationship with that person and let that person have the relationship with God. And so we're trying to unidentify with the egoic mind, unidentify with this false self, and re-identify with who we really are, who we knew we were as small children, before we hit the age of reason. And steps 4 through 7 are this process of doing just that. Going through and identifying the character defects and going through the process of putting those aside so that we can see who we really are. And now steps 8 and 9 are restoring that relationship with others. Now, to use this same mode of thought, then what we're really doing when we establish a relationship with another, we are identifying with them. We are connecting with them. We are becoming one with them. And we are unidentifying with anything that keeps us from them. So what is this eighth step that we've been talking about here? Many of you know it by heart. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Made a list of all persons that we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Now it sounds just so kind of perfunctory. We're just going to sit there and make a list. But if you dig a little bit deeper, what the eighth step is really saying is that it is a recognition of our complete interconnectedness with every other person on this planet. And every other person that we come in contact with, every person that we're in relationship with, it's this recognition that if we don't have that connection, there's going to be something wrong with our lives. There's going to be something compromised in our lives. In fact, the whole life, the recovered life, the transformed life, the hallmark of that life is the connection with each other. And so to begin to foster that, begin to walk down that, is exactly what we're talking about. Have you ever watched rain just start to fall on a pond or a swimming pool? You know, the surface is flat. It's just like glass, right? And the first drop hits, and you watch it, and the ripples come out. And then another drop over here, another ripple, drop over here. And then faster and faster. So the ripples don't have time to completely dissipate before the next one falls. And they're overlapping and crossing each other. And then finally, as the rain really gets going, the whole surface is just vibrating, right? You ever watch that? That's the way it is in this room. That's the way it is in your home. That's the way it is across the globe. Every one of us sitting where you're sitting right now is creating these ripples that move out into the room, and they're connecting and intersecting with all the others, and the whole room is just vibrating with the energy, with the effect of your choices, with just who you are. We can't help but be affected by everyone else around us. Everyone that we come in contact with affects us, and we affect them. It's this corporate human vibration. And to think that we don't affect each other is one of the fallacies. That we can go through life thinking, oh, I'm only harming myself if I do something. No, it affects everybody that we're around. It affects people that we don't even think we know. But this interconnection is what life is really like. It's what the bottom line of our existence is all about. And we have to keep that in mind. There is a blast zone that radiates out from us, or a comfort zone that radiates out from us. And we need to be aware of the effect that we're having as we go through life. Sometimes I use these older illusions and no one knows what I'm talking about. Mr. Magoo, how many remember Mr. Magoo? You know? Walked through life completely oblivious or unaware to the destruction that he was creating all around him. He sailed through and everybody else is left picking up the pieces. Maybe that's a good place to be, completely oblivious of all that stuff. You just get to be happy as a clam, you know. Just don't look back. But that's a lot of what goes on. We are oblivious to what we are doing, but the effect is real. The effect is there. It's changing us all the time. I wanted to read this little piece of a meditation written by John Donne. Here's where, you know, my literary geek days come back to me. John Donne was a 17th century English cleric. He was an Anglican priest and also a poet and a writer and a philosopher. But he writes, and this is a famous passage, you'll recognize parts of it, "All mankind is of one author and is one volume. When one man dies, one chapter is not torn out of the book, but translated into a better language. And every chapter must be so translated. As therefore, the bell that rings out to a sermon calls not the preacher only, but upon the congregation to come. So this bell calls us all. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a cloud be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind, and therefore, never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee." A beautiful reminder of our interconnection. everything diminishes us if it diminishes another, and everything increases another if it increases us. This is the true nature of a relationship in our community. But we miss it. We don't realize how interconnected that we really are. So step 8 is there to help us to make these connections. And there are two parts to step 8. Notice, the first one is to make the list. And that's all about awareness. Becoming aware of the people that have been affected by our behavior. We make the list, we create this awareness of this interconnectedness and how we have affected others. How our choices, not just affecting ourselves, but affect the others. And the idea is that we can't go forward. We can't have our future, free future, restored future, without clearing up the wreckage of the past. Because the past affects the present. And so going through and clearing that up, becoming aware enough so that in real time we can avoid the same kind of disconnective practices with each other is absolutely essential. About 20 years ago, when I first started preparing for the pastorate, I was taking, was doing pastoral training at the church I was at, and it included a form of discipleship where I met with a pastor on a regular basis and we talked. And one of the things that he had me do was to do an 8th and 9th step, even though he didn't call it that, and I had no knowledge of the steps whatsoever. But he said I needed to think about all the people that I'd hurt, and I needed to call them and seek their forgiveness, is the way that he put it. And so I did that. I was being obedient. But it's sneaky, because all I wanted to do was think about the big stuff. It's kind of like when I was a kid going to confession in the Catholic Church, and you get in there and the door opens up, bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's been so long since my last confession. And then I'm sitting there trying to think of all the things I did wrong. Oh, you're first grade, second grade. How bad can it be? I lied, I cheated, I stealed. After a while, you're just manufacturing things just to have something to say, and get your penance and go say your penance and go on to recess. And we kind of, there's a temptation to do that with the 8 step. Is like, okay, let's think about the really big things. Did I embezzle? Did I commit adultery? These big things that we've done. But that's to miss the point of what this is really all about. Because it's really easy to just think about a few big things and miss the fabric, the daily fabric of your life. That's really the key. The 12 and 12 has something really interesting here. I just wanted to read a couple of paragraphs because they bring it right down. The 12 and 12 are the 12 steps in the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, where they kind of go through and explain the 12 steps and the 12 traditions that have been in place for about 80 years. But it comes down to what really constitutes harm. If you have harmed another person, does it have to be this big, heinous thing? Or are there other things that we need to consider as well? They write, we might next ask ourselves what we mean when we say we have harmed other people. What kinds of harm do people do to one another anyway? To define the word harm in a practical way, we might call it the result of instincts in collision. That's neat. We call it the result of instincts in collision. Our survival instincts colliding with other people's survival instincts, right? Which cause physical, mental, emotional, or spiritual damage to people. If our tempers are consistently bad, we arouse anger in others. If we lie or cheat, we deprive others not only of their worldly goods, but of their emotional security and peace of mind. We really issue them an invitation to become contemptuous and vengeful. If our sex conduct is selfish, we may excite jealousy, misery, and a strong desire to retaliate in kind. Such gross misbehavior is not by any means a full catalog of the harms we do. Let us think of some of the subtler ones, which can sometimes be quite as damaging. Suppose that in our family lives, we happen to be miserly, irresponsible, callous, or cold. Suppose that we are irritable, critical, impatient, and humorless. Suppose we lavish attention on one member of the family and neglect the others. What happens when we try to dominate the whole family, either by a rule of iron or by a constant outpouring of minute directions for just how their lives should be lived from hour to hour? What happens when we wallow in depression, self-pity, oozing from every pore? And inflict that upon those that make a daily living with us as practicing alcoholics, difficult and often unbearable. I didn't read that very well. Such a roster of harm done others, the kind that make daily living with us difficult and often unbearable, could be extended almost indefinitely. When we take such personality traits as these into shop, office, and the society of our fellows, they can do damage almost as extensive as that we have caused at home. And so the point here is, it's not just the big things, it's the little things that create this atmosphere of dis-ease, this atmosphere of uncomfortability, those ripples going out, creating that vibration within your homes, your offices, and everywhere that you go. To start to go down into those areas and really take a look is to start to distance yourself from the behavior that's not really you. It's what you do because of the fear that you've developed in your life. Anything, no matter how small, that isolates us, separates us, degrades connection and relationship, that's our harm. That's what's going on here. And there's a beautiful line at the end of this passage that the eighth step is the beginning of the end of our isolation from our fellows and from God. It's the beginning of the end of the isolation. This creates the isolation. Going through this process is the beginning of the end of the isolation. And so these first seven steps, or the first seven steps, I'm always interested in the way that Hebrew numbers and symbolism works, because sometimes it's really, it just gives us a greater insight into what's going on. The number seven for the Jews was a number of spiritual perfection. And the way that they came at that is that there are six physical directions, right? There's up and back and side to side and up and down, six. Six plus one was a spiritual perfection that's added to all the physical directions that we can take. Six being a number that was incomplete, the number of incompletion. Seven, the number of completion. And if you think about it, the first seven steps are the completion of this radical change of mind and heart that takes place in repairing the relationship with God and the relationship with ourself. But one more than seven, one more than spiritual perfection, was the notion of rebirth. And so with step eight, we start the process of rebirth as we restore our relationships with everyone that's around us. And that's really what's going on. This sense of rebirth, this beginning of the end of our isolation from each other and from God, is what this is all about. So, to me, this spurs another question. What's the purpose of life? It's just a little question, right? If this rebirth is this beginning of the end of this isolation, then what are we here to do? What's the whole purpose that we're here for? Well, the first word that usually pops into our head, well, it's love, right? We're supposed to learn how to love. Well, that's not bad. You know, love. Or is it salvation? Maybe the purpose is salvation. We're here to get saved. We're here to come back to God. Well, maybe that's love again. You know, why are we here? Is it to glorify God? How do we do that? Well, we just said we do that by recognizing and living our relationship, the dynamic of our actual relationship with God. Well, if God is love, the Bible tells us God is love, right? If love is identification, Merton tells us that. You don't have to buy it or not, but just go with me for a while on this. If God is love and love is identification, oneness, unity, then our purpose here on earth would be to learn to live in unity and oneness and connection, identification with each other, with our true self, with God, everything that we're talking about here. The steps are a way through the actual purpose of life, which is to bring everything together. Is this true? Well, you know, nothing focuses the mind like a deadline, I think. And when Jesus was facing the deadline of his crucifixion, he prayed a prayer that took the entire chapter of 17 in the Gospel of John. And that entire prayer was all about one thing. And I want to just read a little bit from verse 20 and 23. Jesus, at this time, right before the crucifixion, he says, I do not ask for these only, but also for those who will believe in me through their word, that they may all be one, just as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they also may be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. The glory that you have given me, I have given to them, that they may be one, even as we are one. I in them, and you in me, that they may become perfectly one, so that the world may know that you sent me, and love them even as you love me. What's Jesus saying? If A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C. He's saying everything is oneness. All those ripples creating just one sense of vibration, connection with each other. He's praying for that unity. He's praying that we fulfill our purpose. Our purpose. We talk about God's will all the time, don't we? But we think of will as a legal instrument. We think of will as this juggernaut, you know, this immovable force that moves through life. But will, sebyana in Aramaic, means pleasure, delight, deepest purpose. God's will is his deepest purpose. If God is love, if God is unity, if God is identity, then Jesus' prayer here is the expression of that purpose. God's purpose, his purpose, our purpose, if we're going to be one with him. Step 8 is the beginning of the end of hataha, which is Aramaic for sin, understood as something less than the perfect unity of God. Missing the mark of that unity. Separation is sin. As we live in our isolation, as we live beholden to the excessive, obsessive, compulsive behaviors that continue to degrade our relationships, we're living literally in the separation of sin, less than the unity of God. To come back to that is everything that has to do with our purpose in life. To learn how to do that, day to day, moment by moment. At Acts 4:32, now the full number of those who believed were of one heart and soul, and no one said that any of the things that belonged to him was his own, but they had everything in common. This sense of community, all for one and one for all. That early church was voluntary communism. They brought all their increase for the week and dropped it on the table and divvied it up so that everybody had something, had enough. How beautiful is that? Scary, right? This is mine. Property rights, you know? To voluntarily let all that go, to realize that we are all connected, we are all one. This is what's going on here. All the spiritual, emotional, and psychological work that we do in life really should be about, could be about, just practicing oneness. Getting rid of all the stuff, getting shut of all the things that limit us, disconnect us, make us feel isolated and alone. God's will, God's sebyana, is that we are one. His deepest purpose, it's not a what, it's not the details that we sometimes look for in God's will in our life. It's this how of unity, it's this how of connection, the tightening of our relationships. And there's a Hebrew word for this state of being in oneness. It's called shalom. Now, I know you've heard shalom before. Shlama in Aramaic, or selama in Aramaic. Same word, same concept. But we think of it as peace. And we think of peace as the absence of conflict. But for the Hebrew, it means something much deeper. For the Hebrew, it literally has to do with a surrender. It has to do with a letting go, a dependence, a connection. It has to do with the greatest amount of prosperity, wholeness, wellness, relationship, all of those things at the same time. That's why the Jews use it as a greeting, both hello and goodbye, wishing that wholeness, that connection on everybody that comes close. To be fulfilled, to be completed, is shalom. Any diminishment of shalom is hataha, is sin. So we're going for this idea of shalom and unity. Step 8 is the beginning of the end of hataha, the beginning of the end of isolation, and the beginning of shalom for us and for others. And so this process of shalom, this process of connection, this process of ending our isolation first, is to dig deep. Got to be ruthless. Must dig deep. Pick at the scabs of those wounds, those old wounds, those relationships, and ruthlessly trace the swath of destruction that we've left in life. We have to do this. And we have to go all the way down to the things that we can easily justify. Because the second part of the step is to become willing to make amends. If you're going to become willing to make amends to these people, the first thing that you have to do is to go through a process of forgiveness. Because what I found in doing this, the people that I had hurt, generally speaking, they had hurt me too. It's a two-way street. This usually works both ways. And so it's real easy if I think, well, I hurt this person, yeah, but they hurt me. It's really easy to go right down that line and start to justify, to start to push off and let myself off the hook. But to go through the process of forgiveness is to let go of the things that have been done to me and to take hold of my responsibility, what I have done to degrade those relationships, and to make the steps to move forward, to not make them anymore, to make the steps to move forward, to restore those relationships. But it's not about the restoration of the relationship that is the key here, even in step 9, as we make amends where possible. Because restoration is not under our control. The willingness to be restored, the dropping of all our resentments, the dropping of all of our blaming of others, of our deflection of our own degraded state, of our own isolation, is really the key to what's going on here. To become willing to do what is ever needed for shalom, from inside out, from awareness to forgiveness to amends. That's what this is about. And this begs another question. Are you ready to end your isolation? Are you ready for shalom? Are you ready to be free? You know, people have to be ready to be free. You can lift a real oppressive government, but if the people aren't ready to be free, they will just devolve into something even worse. Happens all the time. We have to be ready to be free. And if we're not ready, what are we doing here? That's what Jesus is asking. I love this last thing that we're going to end with at John 5, starting at verse 2. Now there is in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate a pool, in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has 5 roofed colonnades. In these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. Years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be healed?" Duh, right? The sick man answered him, though, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I am going, another steps down before me." And Jesus said to him, "Get up, take your bed, and walk." This is the classic thing. I love that these details are in our scripture. Jesus recognizes the problem with the man is not his paralysis. It's not his physically invalid status. It has nothing to do with that. He's been there for 38 years, and he's got no one to put him in the pool? What is the status of his relationships? You want to talk about isolation? That's his hataha. That's the state of his sin. He's got no relationships for 38 years lying by this pool. Jesus has to ask him, "Do you want to be healed? Do you wish to be well? Do you desire to be restored?" And here's the kicker. The word he uses there for want, wish, desire, guess what word that is? It's the verb form of sebyana, sama. In other words, the word that the Jews used for the will of God, the deepest purpose of God, the desire, the delight, the pleasure of God, is the same word that Jesus is using here. What's he asking him? Is it your pleasure to be restored? Is it your delight to end your isolation? Is it your deepest purpose to live in unity and connection? And he can't say yes. What does he do? He starts blaming others. Blaming the pool, blaming the nature of things. He's not ready yet. And still, Jesus says, "All right, get up, pick up your pallet, and walk." How do we know if we have become ready for the end of our isolation? Jesus is asking. He's patiently waiting. Do you want to get well? Is it your desire? Is it your purpose to be restored? When he says to pick up your pallet and walk, will you do it? Will you make other excuses? Well, of course I can't. I'm too weak today. Each moment is our chance to pick up our pallet and walk. Each moment is our chance to move forward with the end of our isolation. And Jesus is always there, always offering. His healing hand is right there. All we have to do is not say yes. Just pick up our pallet and go. Approach the next person, the next relationship, with that deepest purpose of connecting, of having nothing stand between us. And then we know we're ready. And then we know the beginning of the end of our isolation is at hand. Let's pray. Father, I just want to thank you for making it clear in your word the order of things. Making it clear in your word the promises that you have for us. That you are always patiently waiting. That you will never leave or forsake us. That all the power that we need if we just hitch our wagon to you is available at any moment. Help us to stop relying on ourselves. Help us to stop trying to control everything, living in fear, and just turn ourselves over this moment right here, right now. And the next moment when we've taken control back, help us to realize as quickly as possible and just turn and face you again. It is so good to be your dependent, Lord. It is so good to let the world turn without us having to bark out the orders. It is so good not to know things and just show up and enjoy the ride. Help us to do more of that. Help us to be those excited kids at your party, this life that you've given us. And when the difficulties come, when the things get tough, to just turn and face you, take your hand, crawl into your lap, and know that Daddy is going to take care of it somehow in ways that we don't understand. Thank you for being that God for us, Lord. Thank you for allowing us to be your children. We want to grow in you each and every day, learning to love because you loved us first. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.